They've been raised to believe, and by now they helplessly believe, that no matter how terrible their lives may be, and their lives have been quite terrible, and no matter how far they fall, no matter what disaster overtakes them, they have one enormous knowledge and consolation, which is like a heavenly revelation. At least they are not black. Now I suggest that of all the terrible things that can happen to a human being, that is one of the worst. I suggest that what has happened to white Southerners is in some ways, after all, much worse than what has happened to Negroes there.
James Baldwin, one of the leading voices of the civil rights movement, during a debate with conservative author William F. Buckley Jr. in 1965. We'll look back at that famous debate and how it still informs the conversation about race in America today later in the show. But first, several weeks back, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg warned his company about the risks an Elizabeth Warren presidency would pose for their bottom line. The Democratic presidential candidate has been critical of the company's ad policy and accused them of taking money to promote lies. But Zuckerberg isn't just meeting with his own company. New reports say he's dining with powerful conservatives, trying to make allies and stay out of the White House's crosshairs. That's after President Trump threatened to sue Facebook and Google in June and pressured the Justice Department to take action against perceived enemies. What does this say about Facebook and social media's role in politics with a presidential election right around the bend? We're joined by two guests. Daniel Lipman is White House and Washington reporter for Politico. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
And Bob Schrum is director of USC's Center for the Political Future and a former political strategist. And it's nice of you to come on the show.
Happy to be here.
Daniel, I want to start with you. Tell me about these meetings that Zuckerberg is holding with conservatives. Who's attending? What's on the agenda?
So he has been meeting this whole year with different conservatives, including Lindsey Graham, a Republican senator, who insinuated that Facebook had become a monopoly during a congressional hearing last year. He's met with Tucker Carlson, who said that Facebook and Zuckerberg have contributed to the death of free speech in America. And Hugh Hewitt, who a conservative radio talk show host, who has also been critical of the company. He's also met with a number of other conservative thought leaders. And on the agenda is a variety of issues like free speech, partnerships, tech bias, competition. And this is all an effort to try to mollify conservatives to prevent them from pressuring the White House to, you know, tweak Facebook's business model or break them up. And so this is a really business. These are business-focused meetings to try to get Facebook on conservatives' good side.
And why is he so intent on this? Why does he believe that conservatives are after that? I mean, those are threats that have been coming at Facebook from the left, from the liberal side, from people like presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren. Have they also been coming from conservatives?
Yeah, conservatives have been very critical of the company, saying that they are biased against them and are trying to censor their own free speech. And so right now, Republicans are the ones in power in Washington, at least in the executive branch. And so he has to cultivate those relationships pretty carefully. And so he met with President Trump recently, and they had a nice meeting that was attended by Jared Kushner and Dan Scavino. And so, you know, he's really catering to people who are close to the White House, who can kind of tell the White House, yeah, Facebook, you know, they've gotten much better. They're listening to our concerns. And so it's not an irrational strategy.
And Facebook did a year-long conservative bias audit, didn't they, earlier? What did they find, and how are they addressing the problems?
Yeah, so it was conducted by former Senator John Kyle and a team from his law firm, Covington Burling, where they interviewed 133 conservative lawmakers and groups for the audit, and it did result in changes to Facebook's advertising policies, and it did get some criticism because Democrats are saying that the allegations that Facebook censors conservatives are hogwash, that, you know, conservative publications like Fox, Breitbart, The Daily Wire, they're among the highest rated publishers on Facebook, and so there's really nothing to worry about. And so basically, liberals feel like conservatives are playing the refs and trying to get even better treatment from Facebook.
Bob Schrum, let me bring you into the conversation now. The Democratic presidential candidate, Elizabeth Warren, recently slipped by an ad on Facebook that had some false information at the top of it, and then she was trolling the company. What does it say to you that it was so easy for her to slip this onto the platform, and especially in light of all the criticism that Facebook has come under these past years now for promoting fake news?
Well, Facebook argues that it's going to obey the same rules that television stations have to obey, and broadcast TV stations are not allowed to reject candidate ads. So that's the rationale that they're using. I think that their long-term interest would be to set up an entity that checked these ads for accuracy, not just candidate ads, but ads from any non-campaign that's involved in the political process.
What do we know about how much people trust Facebook at this point? I mean, do they trust them?
By the way, there's a lot of distrust of newspapers, a lot of distrust of network television. And the way Facebook operates, they figure out what news you like to see in your news feed, and they send you news that reinforces, I think, the views that you already have. So I do think they have a big impact. I think they need to find a neutral way, but they don't want to do this, I guess, find a neutral way to convey their services. But they're worried about the bottom line. They're worried about profit. They're like any other business. They'd like to profit from the conservatives who go there because they read what they like, the liberals who go there because they read what they like. Social media has transformed America in such fundamental ways that it's very, very, very powerful. And there's been no serious think or rethink about how it should be regulated, how it affects the system, and whether or not we ought to impose standards on it that maybe we don't impose, for example, on broadcast TV.
Mark Zuckerberg has said, when people have asked him, why are you meeting with conservatives? He says, I meet with all sorts of people. You should try it. You know, I'm trying to run a business here. I need the information. What do you think when you hear today that Zuckerberg, that he's meeting with any kind of politically leaning organizations?
Well, Politico or the Washington Post would meet with politicians from all sides and do all the time. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think what's wrong is if they do get to the point where they're playing the ref, where, as Daniel suggested, they're just trying to satisfy the people who are in the White House right now and who may very well not be there in a matter of a little over a year. As a practical matter, if what that turns into is how do I cater to Trump and the people who are supporting him right now, I think that is short-term and threatens the long-term health of Facebook and invites regulation.
Is there one side of the political aisle that's more active on social media now? Do we know this?
Yes, I think conservatives right now, at least on Facebook, have been more active. And certainly conservative candidates in terms of buying ads have been more active. I think that will rebalance once the Democrats have a nominee. I think Democrats will spend a substantial amount of money on Facebook, and Trump obviously will spend a lot of money on Facebook. He's raised a lot of money.
How has the campaign and political ad landscape changed since you worked for them back then?
Profoundly. The Internet in 2004 had its first huge impact on politics, which was the democratization of fundraising. John Kerry raised nearly $250 million, much of it on the Internet, before the Democratic convention. He then made the mistake, as he would say, of taking federal funding during the general election, which I think hobbled us in what was a very close election. But now people receive so much of their information on Facebook, especially younger voters, and Twitter and Instagram. And, you know, there is a lot of data that says, and this we haven't talked about because it's not directly about advertising, that the folks that people trust most are the people they know. So that if you can get something into the bloodstream on Facebook, either through an ad or through a bot or some other way, and it's picked up and repeated by a friend of yours, that's going to have a real impact. You can also micro-target people on entities like Facebook and on social media in general. Now, you still have to be careful of this. because the Clinton campaign in 2016, everybody's always looking for a silver bullet, and they thought that Obama had found one and they were going to use it with social media. You still have to win the message war, and you still have to communicate on broadcast television because such a substantial portion of the electorate gets its information there. That will change, obviously, as we undergo generational change. But right now, it's not a magic bullet. It can have a pernicious effect. It can have a beneficial effect. And I think what Facebook is facing is the prospect of regulation under a Democratic president. They don't like it. They hate it. They worry about what it will do to their profit and their bottom line. And if I were them, I would behave a little more subtly as they're dealing with these issues.
Bob Schramm, director of USC's Center for the Political Future. Daniel Lipman is White House and Washington reporter for Politico. Coming up, when critics charged Fox News with bias, the network often pointed to one anchor as proof of their balance, Shepard Smith, what his departure means for Fox. That's next on Prex Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. It's Tuesday, time for TV on the radio.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get those.
Oh my God, they've killed Kenny!
Three words for you, treat, yoke, sell.
I am the one who knocks.
That's what she said.
Fox News anchor Shepard Smith announced his resignation at the end of last week.
This is my last newscast here. Thank you for watching today and over the decades as I traveled to many of your communities and anchored this program, Studio B and Fox Report, plus endless marathon hours of breaking news. It's been an honor and my pleasure. Even in our currently polarized nation, it's my hope that the facts will win the day, that the truth will always matter, that journalism and journalists will thrive. I'm Shepard Smith. Fox News, New York.
He was known as one of the network's most even-handed hosts. The anchor Fox News repeatedly pointed to when critics accused it of being a full-on propaganda machine for the current administration. Well, with Smith now gone, what does it mean for the station's reputation going forward? Joining us now is David Falkenflik. He's a media correspondent for NPR News and co-host of NPR's On Point. And good to have you here.
Thanks, Barbara.
How surprised were you by Shep Smith's departure? Was it something you anticipated?
In the moment, it was incredibly surprising. You could see it drain the blood from the face of Neil Cavuto, who took the handoff at 4 o'clock immediately after Shep's announcement on the air. Other reporters on the air on the channel sort of announced their astonishment. I shared it in the moment. But if you look at the overall dynamic playing out, it's seemingly inevitable. You had, as you pointed out in your introduction, Shep Smith, a guy who really valued the notion of even-handedness, of fairness, not necessarily Fox has this motto, fair and balanced. The idea is you're supposed to, in the news side, be fair and you're supposed to be balanced. Everybody has exactly the same weight put on them. That's not actually a fair thing to do to the news or to your viewers and listeners. You want to be fair to the facts, be fair to the truth, be fair to your audience, and be fair to the people you covered. But that doesn't mean every he said and she said is this thing where you shrug your shoulders, throw up your hands and say, we'll never know. Shep Smith wanted to know. Shep Smith wanted to be able to figure out what the facts were. And think of the journey this guy took. When he came on the air as their anchor, he was brash. He had come from local TV. He had done certain kinds of tabloid news. He was from Mississippi, and he would often go home on weekends kind of rejecting coastal notions of what you should do. And yet he evolved into somebody who was a truth teller, who called people out, who fact-checked, who, when the president violated norms, he said that. When the president said things that were racist. He would use that term too, not only overriding some of the squeamishness of some of his peers and colleagues in other outlets, but overriding the entire thrust of the rest of his network just about, which would approach things very tentatively or tend to cast light toward the president's opponents and in a negative way. So you have Fox as that is tonally an incredibly conservative, opinionated outlet. It does have reporters that work for it. As you say, people pointed to Shep Smith for cover, but there's a reason why he was taken down before the Trump years from his 7 o'clock hour, which was highly watched, people back at home, to a 3 o'clock hour, given the term of the chief anchor of the network when anything broke. But most of those hosts didn't want to give up the real estate. Shep Smith was ensconced at 3 p.m. for a reason.
Yeah, I'm part of the reason, perhaps, we can only assume why he left. To bring it back to the news, he left in the middle of a contract, and people don't generally do that lightly, though. Do we know why he left so abruptly?
He left because of the dynamic of the fact that this network, which had always been opinionated, always been essentially part of the conservative and Republican establishment, tried to, under the late former chairman Roger Ailes, help to determine who the winners would be in the Republican Party, what the winning issues would be, and who the targets would be of their scorn as part of a political as well as a business model. This network went almost all in for Trump during the Trump years. Rupert Murdoch, the controlling owner, not a particularly a fan of Donald Trump from New York, didn't have a lot of respect for him, but thought this will be the first time in which I could have a fully open channel, an entree, a line of communication with the President of the United States, something he's had in his native Australia with prime ministers and UK as well. And because that channel went all in on Trump, you saw Shep Smith, as norms were violated, as facts were ignored or essentially lied about, you know, as notions of shame and truth were discarded by this White House, whatever you think of his policies, Shep Smith called it that way, and that was in tension with other hosts and other leaders for the network. So you saw in recent weeks Tucker Carlson and one of his guests, Joe DiGenova, a former Republican prosecutor turned frequent talking head, turned person kind of operating on the fringes of Trump world, deriding Shep Smith and one of his legal analysts, a Fox News paid analyst, that's a former state judge in New Jersey, a guy named Andrew Napolitano. Napolitano says, President Trump has some legal exposure here over what's going on, some of these scandals, things going on in Ukraine or others. This is a concern. Tucker Carlson and his guests mock them for it. And then when Smith calls that out in the air the next day, Tucker Carlson invites Joe DiGenova back to do it again. And he got no support from the network. And at that point, Shep Smith said, I may be being paid a ton of money, but this is this isn't supportable. This tension is too much to bear. I'm basically being paid to be bunting, you know, kind of an elegant wrapper around this package that's something very different.
Right. That seemed to be the last straw. He really got into it with Tucker Carlson. So with Shep Smith gone, though, there's Chris Wallace, there's Martha McCallum, there's Brett Beyer, there's Geraldo Rivera. What are the reputations among those four when it comes to handling the news fairly?
Well, you almost got to take them each separately. Shep Smith was not without voice and not without a sensibility and a look at the world, but he wasn't a partisan and he wasn't an ideologue. Geraldo Rivera occasionally criticizes this president, but he's very celebrity-focused and celebrity-friendly, and he likes to be on the good side of this president. He's, tries to support him as best he can, but was a critic of his on immigration. Rivera himself, Latino, and he takes great Puerto Rican extraction, and he takes great exception to some of the president's policies on that, but tends to be very supportive. If you look at Chris Wallace, there's a guy who is very tough on various administration officials. He's had some real exchanges with Stephen Miller, the president's advisor on immigration and other domestic policy matters. And yet Wallace, if you really look at it, is a guest on Fox News, where he's a host, where he commands real estate, is on the Fox Broadcast Network, where he has that Sunday public affairs show. And while I think it's replayed later in the day on Fox News on Sunday afternoon, you know, he's not a mainstay of Fox News. He has a presence there as a guest and an analyst. He's fearless, but he, again, is in isolation. And you see that tension there as well. Martha McCallum is capable of playing it straight, but she's also capable of asking a series of questions that sound a lot like talking points. She is not quite what I would say straight ahead. She is playing to the sensibilities of the audience that Fox is trying to appeal to, which is very much overlapping with the core Trump voter. You look like a guy like Brett Beyer. I think he tries to be straight ahead, but when you look at his panels of the analysts he invites in, I did that for a 6-month period once. It was sort of 2-to-1 liberal to conservative, and often casting mainstream news reporters as though they're liberals in some sort of partisan fight that they are kind of tentative about participating in. So there are these different stripes, these different ways in which to think about these figures, none of them performing the role of a maybe bear to some extent, but on the Fox News Network, you just don't see that many people playing the role straight ahead. One of the ways to look at it is to look at somebody like John Roberts or even Trace Gallagher, I guess, who's filling in for Shep in at least one or two of the days ahead. The way they respond to questions on Shep Smith's show is markedly different than the way they respond to this, to questions on Sean Hannity's show, or Tucker, you know, or if they appear on a Tucker Carlson show or one of the top opinion shows in primetime. There's a leaning into the conservatism of the network, even by their straight reporters. Well, if you don't have somebody like Shep Smith, who is clearly fixed in a place that says, I want to find out the facts and the truth, however inconvenient that is for whomever, the reporters are going to tend towards the sensibilities of their hosts, and it's very clear what they do. And I think that you're watching a lot of reporters behind the scenes at Fox News really feel anxiously, because they've always been able to say, you know, the opinionators can do what they do, but we just try to report the news. And there are a good number of folks there who try to do that. But who can they look to for support?
Well, is there any indication that the network heads are at all worried that they're veering too far into propaganda territory, given that they've also hired people like former Chief Communications Officer Hope Hicks and former White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders? And speaking to what you just said in your last answer, and just briefly.
I mean, it's a hiring pool for the Trump White House, and the Trump White House is a hiring pool for Fox News, both corporately and on the air as well. You know, the fight playing out between Rudy Giuliani and John Bolton are between two Fox contributors right now. I think it's a time of high stakes for the Murdochs and for Fox News. They've gone all in. They've got plenty of profits, plenty of support there from their viewers. And at the same time, as the impeachment crisis mounts for the president, you know, is the reporting that their journalists are going to have to convey on the air to maintain credibility with viewers of stripes other than the most hardcore Trump viewer going to come into conflict with the need to protect the president at all costs? I think the Murdochs, if they need to, will cut ties with President Trump. But I think they're not going to give way on that loyalty until the very last moment they have to do. And we don't know if they'll reach that moment at all.
David, great checking in with you. Thank you.
You bet.
David Folkenflik is NPR News media correspondent and co-host of NPR's On Point. Coming up, in 1965, the writer James Baldwin agreed to participate in a landmark debate about race with the conservative William F. Buckley.
He said he has a responsibility, he has a duty to sit there with people like Buckley and try to expose them for what they are, because they are the ones weaving the web of white supremacy.
How that debate came to define the civil rights era and the light it still sheds on racial conflict in the U.S. today. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. On February 18th, 1965, a crowd of more than 700 people packed Cambridge University's debate hall for an intellectual clash for the ages. In one corner, the Harlem-raised grandson of slaves, leading literary voice of the civil rights movement, James Baldwin. In the other, the wealthy, unabashedly elitist conservative commentator William F. Buckley, Jr. The motion, the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro. Let's listen to a memorable part of Baldwin's argument for the affirmative.
I picked the cotton, and I carried it to market, and I built the railroads under someone else's whip for nothing. For nothing. The Southern oligarchy, which has until today so much power in Washington, and therefore some power in the world, was created by my labor and my sweat.
Buckley argued against the motion.
Well, I don't know of anything that has ever been created without the expense of something. All of you who hope for a diploma here are going to do that at the expense of a considerable amount of effort. And I would thank you, please, not to belie the fact that a considerable amount of effort went into the production of a system which grants a greater degree of material well-being to the American Negro than that is enjoyed by 95% of the other peoples of the human race.
Now, nearly 55 years later, political science professor Nicholas Bicola argues in a new book that the debate still informs the racial divide in America today. Bicola's book is called The Fire is Upon Us, James Baldwin, William F. Buckley Jr., and the Debate Over Race in America. And Nicholas, it's good of you to come on the show today.
Thanks so much, Barbara. I'm so happy to be here.
So before we delve into Baldwin and Buckley, another reason you say that this debate was so significant is the historical context. So remind us what was happening in the civil rights movement at the time the debate took place.
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing. The debate took place, as you said, on February 18th, 1965. The same day we were in the midst of the Selma campaign, and the central issue there was the pursuit of a Voting Rights Act. So the night that Baldwin and Buckley met at Cambridge across the ocean, there was a civil rights activity in Marion, Alabama that many people have seen featured in the film Selma. It was civil rights activity that led to the death of a civil rights activist named Jimmie Lee Jackson. So we're sort of at the apex of the civil rights movement in so many ways. The Civil Rights Act has been adopted. We're fighting for the Voting Rights Act. And so it's in the midst of that turmoil that Baldwin and Buckley met at Cambridge.
Right, that turmoil and that violence. And here you have Baldwin and Buckley already established as outspoken liberal and conservative writers. What did they believe? And why don't we start with Buckley's background? What kind of conservative was he?
Well, William F. Buckley had a brand of conservatism that was all his own. He was raised in a family that was staunchly Catholic and deeply individualist. He called his political doctrine individualism. And by individualism, it was really a catch-all term that Buckley used for a view that was skeptical of government power, especially government power in the economy. It was a political view that was deeply suspicious of the welfare state and deeply suspicious of democracy. And the Buckleys believed through and through, they believed in hierarchy. They believed in that there were some people who were fit to rule and others who were fit to be ruled, and they counted themselves among those who were fit to rule. And so Buckley thought of himself as a defender of a particular kind of conservatism that was unabashedly elitist, and his beliefs in hierarchy were often racialized, which is one of the themes of the book.
Now let's turn to Baldwin, because he's pretty fascinating. He wasn't the most radical of leftists. In fact, he disagreed strongly with the Nation of Islam. What was his position on civil rights, and how did he describe what equality would look like?
Yeah, James Baldwin is somebody who defied categorization in every way, and that's one of the things I think is most fascinating about him. He said very early on in his career that all theories are suspect, and he learned from a very young age it was impossible to indoctrinate him. So he's somebody who grows up in, you know, Harlem storefront churches, spends some time as a young minister. You know, language, the power of words, is really something that Baldwin is able to use to resist that sort of oppression that he's experiencing as a young man in Harlem. But he ends up falling away from the church. He sees a deep spiritual hypocrisy in the ministers that he's working with, and doesn't see them as true believers. And then he also has this short period as a teenager where he's identifies himself as a socialist, and then he discovers around the same time he falls away from the church that he's never really going to be comfortable as adhering to any one particular ideology. His politics requires us to be dynamic. And so I think he has a very clear moral core in what he's trying to do, and that is the freedom and fulfillment, the dignity of every human being. That is what Baldwin cares about more than anything else. But in terms of how we go about achieving that, Baldwin is never comfortable allying himself with any one particular group or any one particular ideology. He's always in the state of trying to think through these issues through the eyes of others and trying to get us to recognize the kind of moral core of all of our political problems.
Now let's get back to the debate. And the motion before the House again was the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro. And let's talk about their different debate strategies. And we should say that this wasn't the kind of debate where there was any back and forth. James Baldwin gave the first speech, and then Buckley gave his full speech. But let's listen first to this excerpt from James Baldwin.
Isn't 400 years enough? 400 years, at least three wars? The American soil is full of the corpses of my ancestors. Why is my freedom or my citizenship or my right to live there? How is it conceivably a question now? And I suggest further that in the same way, the moral life of Alabama sheriffs and poor Alabama ladies, white ladies, that their moral lives have been destroyed by the plague called color, that the American sense of reality has been corrupted by it.
And you write in the book that Baldwin put himself in the role of the prophet Jeremiah at the very beginning of his argument. And you hear it here in this excerpt. And he made a moral argument that racism wounded all Americans. So what do you take away from this part of his speech? And what do you make of the strategy?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. In the 150 years that the Cambridge Union existed, I feel confident in saying that no one who had sat in that chamber had ever experienced something quite like the speech that Baldwin delivered that night. You know, formal debate is this combination of kind of intellectual combat and performance art. And there's often this kind of, you know, combination of wordsmithing and jocularity. But Baldwin's speech was deadly serious. There were a couple moments of levity, but he was there to deliver a Jeremiah in which he exposes white supremacy not only in the ways it impacts the lives of its victims, but the ways it impacts the lives of its would-be beneficiaries. As he says in that passage that you just played for us, Baldwin says that the moral lives of those who are the would-be beneficiaries of white supremacy are destroyed by the plague called color. And what Baldwin is getting at there is he says, well, you know, there's nothing more depressing and sad than looking at a poor white person in the South, and the only thing that person has, the one thing they're hanging on to give them any sense of worth in the world, is this delusion of white supremacy. And Baldwin looks at someone whose life is controlled by this delusion and says that this person is a victim of this way that we've convinced ourselves that we need to think about one another. And so Baldwin is there to say to this audience, right, to this largely sympathetic audience of college students, that we are all the creators and perpetuators of this system of white supremacy, and is our responsibility to do something about it. And that's what he's there to say to the Cambridge audience and to obviously the television audience that's going to see that that debate on both sides of the Atlantic.
Right. And Baldwin spoke from this place of empathy. And Buckley, on the other hand, went on the attack right away. Here he is, right out of the gates.
The fact that you sit here, as is your rhetorical device, and lay the entire weight of the Negro ordeal on your own shoulders is irrelevant to the argument that we are here to discuss.
And, well, you hear his verbal tics in that clip so clearly. He also went on to chide Baldwin for attacking American ideals as insufficient. And then he inserts this little jab.
That our ideals rather are some sort of a superficial coating which we come up with at any given moment in order to justify whatever commercial and noxious experiment we are engaged in. Thus, Mr. Baldwin can write his book, The Fire Next Time, in which he threatens America. He didn't, in writing that book, speak with the British accents that he used exclusively tonight. In which he threatened America with the necessity for us.
So what is Buckley referring to when he says Mr. Baldwin threatens America in his book, The Fire Next Time? The allusion is in the title of your book. And also this British accent line. It seems like such a cheap shot. Was it even accurate?
Yeah. So Buckley, you know, his way of approaching the debate, and he's sitting there listening to Baldwin's speech. Baldwin doesn't, you know, no one in the audience questions Baldwin. You know, the students have the opportunity to stand up and raise questions and points of information with speakers, but no one stood up during Baldwin's speech. It would have been almost profane to do so because he's delivering this powerful sermon, and it would have been kind of absurd in some ways to interrupt him. And so Buckley sees that. He sees Baldwin get this standing ovation, which is a very rare thing to happen at the Union. And he decides that he, as he put it later, is not going to give them one goddamn inch. And so he goes on the attack immediately, which was kind of Buckley's style. He was never comfortable defending his own views. He was always much more comfortable going back to his debating days in high school, being on the attack. And so Buckley's argument, and this is where the British accents point comes in, is Buckley's argument is that Baldwin is fundamentally misleading the audience, and that what he's doing, this reference to British accents, I don't think is meant to be taken literally. Buckley was using accents in a way to sort of say that Baldwin was using a vocabulary that he thought the audience would accept. And so Buckley read Baldwin as this radical, hell-bent on overthrowing Western civilization. You should view him, he says to this elite college audience, as your enemy, and that you're actually showing him a great deal of disrespect, he says to the Cambridge students, by treating him with such adulation. And so Buckley sees the same thing happening on the other side of the Atlantic with The Fire Next Time. When that comes out, that book comes out in 1963, very few critics have anything negative to say about it. And Buckley, following one of his National Review writers, Gary Wills, says this is a sign of great disrespect for Baldwin. You're showing him you're showing him a kind of unction, is the word that Buckley uses in the speech, because you're not respecting what he's written on the page. You're just sort of giving the argument over to him because he is a black man, and you're unwilling to challenge him because he is a black man. And so Buckley, that was his strategy, was basically to say, I am the only one here taking Baldwin's ideas seriously. And he argues that he is there defending Western civilization against Baldwin, who is hell-bent on overthrowing it, which, you know, I argue in the book is really the wrong way to read what Baldwin's up to.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Nicholas Buchola. He's the author of The Fire Is Upon Us, James Baldwin, William F. Buckley, Jr., and the Debate Over Race in America. Well, one thing that you point out in the book is something that Buckley and Baldwin both actually agreed on, and that's that they both took a dim view of the law's ability to resolve racial conflict in the U.S. Flesh that out for us.
Yeah, this is one of the few areas of agreement. You know, of course, Buckley's argument is that, you know, Buckley resists the idea that he is a racist or a white supremacist, and because for Buckley, being a racist means that you have views that are rooted in racial animus, and Buckley claims that he didn't have views that were rooted in racial animus. He had these views that were rooted in this kind of view of racial paternalism, that white supremacy is not a permanent condition, but is a condition based on the superiority of white people, as he put it in 1957, for the time being. And so Buckley was very skeptical from the beginning. You know, he's against any sort of legal intervention to break up the Jim Crow system in the South. He's against the Civil Rights Act. He's against the Voting Rights Act. He's resisting every step of the way. And in part of the argument that he makes, or, you know, this could be seen as a rationalization, is that the law cannot change men's souls. What we need is we need responsible white leaders in the South to bring about an organic, slow, gradual change, and that white people in the South cannot treat black people as a permanent servile class. They need to bring them along. And so I say that if the slogan of the civil rights movement is freedom now, Buckley's slogan is freedom, some freedom one day when we decide you're ready. On the other side, Baldwin is somebody who, you know, and he often frustrated some of his contemporaries. He was also skeptical of politics and skeptical of law. He says that, you know, from his very earliest writings in the 40s, he's seeing political candidates on the scene that are promising, you know, all sorts of things to African Americans. And he says, look, it's very hard for us, given our experience in this country, to trust anything that you say. And so Baldwin is somebody who is, of course, celebrating in his own way all these steps of advancement in the black liberation struggle. But what Baldwin is constantly reminding us is that any step in the right direction, any election that turns out the way we want it to turn out, any piece of legislation or court decision that we love, this is progress, but we have so much more work to do, and we're never going to be able to do that work until we come to grips with our history and take responsibility for it.
Well, ultimately, how does all of this inform race relations today? What's the lasting legacy of this?
Well, the lasting legacy, I think, you know, I mean, there's a lot of lasting legacies, but I think one of the major, you know, the two major points I would make about that. One is that Buckley recognizes at some point, you know, right around the mid-60s, he recognizes that a kind of straight defense of segregation, resistance to civil rights is no longer going to work. And so what he begins to do is to say, I'm, you know, not going to focus on the South anymore. I'm not going to focus on these questions of civil rights. I'm going to focus on the kinds of issues that I think can be engines of racial resentment. I'm going to focus on busing. I'm going to focus on fair housing laws. And what I'm going to say is that this white backlash against the black liberation struggle is entirely justified. And so right before the Cambridge debate, 1964, Buckley devotes an issue of National Review to the race problem and the election. And everything that he focuses on there is in trying to channel racial resentment into conservative ascendancy. And Buckley runs for mayor of New York City in 1965, and his candidacy is supported by people in the outer boroughs. It's not supported by white elites. It's supported by working class folks who feel this sense of racial resentment. And Buckley, I think, in many ways, anticipates the kind of populist politics that we're seeing today that really taps into racial resentment in order to advance an agenda that really has nothing to do with working class whites. It has everything to do with conserving the power of elites. And that's very relevant for today. And I think on the Baldwin side of things, what Baldwin, I think, teaches us, I think, so masterfully is that we make a mistake when we focus all of our attention on the demagogues, on the most obvious manifestations of white supremacy in our society. The mistake that we make is that we often are able to dismiss these sort of these demagogues as evil, and that's our major problem. Baldwin was always asking us to dig beneath the surface, always asking us to say, well, it may be true that that person is evil, but who is really providing them with power? What does the soil look like out of which that person grows? And so if Baldwin were to look at the world that we now inhabit, the country that we inhabit today, Baldwin would be very interested in getting us to go beyond saying those who disagree with me are evil and try to understand that they're actually scared because they don't have a sense of identity that can give their lives meaning. And so that's the call that Baldwin makes to all of us, and I think that's one of his most powerful legacies.
Well, thank you so much for the book. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Barbara. It's been a pleasure.
Nicholas Bukola's new book is called The Fire Is Upon Us. Coming up on our show, though, it is so hard to speak from the heart when you're giving a wedding toast and do it well. So why not have someone write it for you? A professional wedding speechwriter. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. It can strike fear into the hearts of the best of groomsmen and maids of honor, fathers and mothers of the bride. The dreaded wedding toast. It can be warm, heartfelt, and bring down the house. Or it could go something like this.
When my brother, Harold, asked me to be the best man at his wedding, I was like, oh, of course, man, because you've always been there for me. Because Harold, you know, he's always been the dependable one, and I've always been the screwed up one. Right, Dad? Why can't you be more like your brother? Harold would never beat up his landlord. But Harold ain't so perfect. Remember that time in Puerto Rico when we picked up those two, I guess they were prostitutes, but I don't remember paying.
Okay, how about that?
How about that?
The best man, everybody.
Best man, the better man.
And that's from the 1998 film The Wedding Singer. But what if you could hire someone to write the toast for you? Well, you can. Den Pope does just that. He's a professional wedding toast writer, and he joins me now. Hi, Den.
Hi, Barbara. Great to be here.
So, yes, I mean, the best thing about wedding toasts is that you don't know what might go horribly wrong, right? I mean, it's the least predictable part of a wedding, and I'm sure that you have heard people go off on those tangents or crash and burn at weddings that you've gone to. So do you have any examples of that and how it showed you what not to do in your work?
Well, from my experience, the worst speeches are the ones where, well, two things. They either say, oh, I'm going to wing it, which are usually disastrous because it always takes a lot longer to tell a story than we think it does. Or there's the person who will script out a very long speech that is filled with empty platitudes. We've all heard, I'm not losing a daughter, I'm gaining a son. And we've all heard things from best men like, well, Jim, if I'm the best man, why is she marrying you? And things like that that have been around, you know, since the Eisenhower administration that we've all heard over and over and over. So, you know, everyone has a fun, warm, original speech inside of them. I do know that. But it's just getting to that that is a challenge.
Okay, so how does this process work? What type of information are you trying to draw out to get a good, authentic, sincere speech? And what kind of effort goes into it to wring that out of your clients?
Sure. A speaker will come to me, and they'll have always a very general feeling and a general sense of love and pride around the person. But they don't often know for sure what specifically they feel about it or how they would define the bride or groom in their relationship with them. So I run them through a two-step process. After they book their speech, I'll send them a discussion guide that I create, and it'll have about 15 or so questions about the bridegroom and their relationship with them.
Like what?
So I might ask a question, for example, of a father. What story from any point best exemplifies her personality, values, or characteristics in your eyes? That's step one. Step two, I'll spend about an hour on the phone with them going deeper on some of the information, because every word of this thing has to be in their voice and personality. If it's not, two horrible things happen. Number one, they're going to be miserable delivering it because they have to try and become someone else. And number two, and this is the problem with a lot of wedding speeches that you hear, is that the audience can spot a phony a mile away and inauthenticity, and they'll reject it.
Okay, so then what are you going for? Do you have these landmarks you're going to hit that every speech has to have, like open with a joke, have one really great anecdote, that kind of thing?
No, absolutely not. And this is the best part, but yet the challenging part of what I do is that every speech is different. For example, I was talking last week with a father in South Africa, and he told me his daughter was born 6 weeks premature and weighed less than 4 pounds. And he had vivid memories while he held her in the delivery room. She didn't even extend to his elbow. So in his case, ultimately, I was able to detect he's surprised and he's a little bit perplexed that he's even speaking at his daughter's wedding. So in his case, we're going to incorporate that sentiment of surprise, along with a little awe, a little gratitude. So that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the unusual or the gold, really, that oftentimes people don't know they have.
Okay, so you write the speech. Do you do any coaching of how they're going to deliver it, or is that completely out of your control?
No, I do. I can tell you that I don't want their delivery to be perfect.
That would be weird. That would be like a robot.
Exactly. And most performance coaching today tries to turn you into someone that you're not currently in terms of gesturing or saying a word a certain way or emphasizing that or emphasizing that. And that may work very well in the business world and in job interviews, but it's extremely detrimental in the social speech world, where you need to be authentic, you need to be real, you need to be completely yourself. So I want them to do everything that you and I are doing in this conversation. I'm messing up words, I'm pausing, my cadence varies, I'm gesturing, because that's what people are used to. It feels natural and easy to them. So I want, you know, I don't want them to run themselves in the ground rehearsing. I want them to become familiar with the content and the tone, but I want it to be fresh to them too, a little bit, when they stand up to give it.
All right, you're married, right?
I am.
What were the toasts like at your wedding?
Bad. They're bad for
what happened?
They're dull, rambling, off point, and you know, at the end of them you're sort of left with an empty feeling that they didn't quite connect in the way that I would hope they would have connected on this, you know, one eventful, important day in one's life.
I hope you have a recommitment ceremony at some point and they hire you to write the toast for you.
I can tell you, and maybe this relates and will help put both of our minds at ease, but I can tell you ironically, perhaps, that I am not a public speaker, nor do I enjoy it. I am like most people who are moderately, if not severely, terrified of public speaking. You know, as Seinfeld said famously, most of us would rather be in the coffin at a funeral than giving the eulogy. And I put myself in that category, too.
Right. And in that scenario, eulogies and wedding toasts are very similar.
They are. And I do write a lot of eulogies as well. And it's like the opposite sides of the same coin or bookends in a way. You know, most eulogies are little more than resumes, you know, and then he moved to White Plains and began working for IBM kind of stuff. So with eulogies, I put people through a very similar process. And in my mind, they are both celebrations, but they are celebrations of a different type, if that makes sense.
It absolutely does. Den, very interesting talking with you. I hope you live long and prosper.
Thank you, Barbara. And hey, listen, if you have a wedding speech to give, get in touch.
Den Pope, he's a professional wedding toast and eulogy speechwriter.
Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married. Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married.
That'll do it for us for today. Don't forget you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast and listen whenever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay. I'm Barbara Bogave. I'll see you tomorrow.